ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There's ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin, Middlemass and Ed Cowan. And we are at the Olympic Hotel for a live record. You'll be familiar with the theme, of course. Everyone's got it set as their ringtone. And here we are, ready to go for a live edition of the ABC Cricket Podcast. What a setting, Teddy, on Wednesday night.
Corb, I'm absolutely amped for this. Great to see so many unfamiliar faces because you're kind of back on, you know, family and friends turning up to an event like this. But I don't... I don't know many, and the sense of community and love, it's awesome. I'm pretty pumped.
Are you, how have you been spending your week? Sort of, have you been going to work or have you been playing golf?
Well, I've been going to work, but I'll probably post about golf at some point in time on my social media just to rub it in everyone's faces.
Jeez, so we've had a few days, obviously, to get our head around the events. I think we've spoken twice already since then. Well, just put your finger in the wind for me, Teddy. Where are you sitting as we're still multiple days out from the start of the Brisbane test, and yet we've got this two-day sample size already in the series so far?
Look, I haven't changed my view. I think Australia will win the Ashes 3-1. I actually think the risky test for Australia is this next one. Pink ball, conditions that will suit stroke play. I think we think of pink ball tests historically as Adelaide test matches. 10 mils of grass, swing, seam, hard batting conditions, and obviously the lights come on and, you know, whether it's Mitch Stark or Trent Bolt, and batting becomes impossible. They aren't really the conditions in Brisbane. Less grass, ball goes softer because of the type of clay, and less grass, of course. And so, you know, time of day matters, but I actually think... and maybe it's the emotional terrorism that the English team play. I think this is a risky test for Australia.
It's happened before, though. I mean, Shamar Joseph, obviously, a couple of years ago. So you just need... You get the wrong end of the conditions, and all of a sudden one bowler
and
comes
good
off.
And good fast bowling. Yeah. And they've got good fast bowling. The downside of the two-day test is Wood's going to be fit. Archer's going to be fit. If there's anything that came out of that test match that was a silver lining, it had to be that. There's no way they were banking on both of those players playing the first three test matches, but there's a situation now where they could.
I caught up with a lot of the analysis from the various other podcasts and shows that are out there, and particularly the English, just to get a little bit of a feel as to how it landed there. And Michael Vaughan, on his sort of multiple platforms, obviously a colleague of ours with the BBC, was almost pleading with England to basically send some batsmen at least to that tour game, obviously being played at Manuka Oval. Instead, we know it's going to be Matthew Potts, Jacob Bethell, Josh Tung. That's it. So they're the only three guys that drop out of England's test squad to play in the tour game.
The poor bastards don't get a week at the Novotel in Noosa on Hastings Street. Like, how bad? Not only do you have to run the drinks for these idiots, you don't get to go to Noosa.
So the other train of thought is, well, they played a warm-up game in Perth. It didn't help them. That low bounce at Lilac Hill. Why would the low bounce at Manuka Oval help them, even if it is a pink ball and under lights?
I would say this. So Lilac Hill is a club cricket ground. So, yes, Manuka isn't necessarily the Gabba. The Gabba isn't the Gabba that we kind of associate many moons ago. It's a pretty good, consistent batting wicket where there's probably 10% or 15% more bounce than other wickets in Australia. Manuka is a first-class cricket ground. They play test match cricket there. They play a lot of first-class cricket. They play big bash cricket there. The variation between a club cricket ground and a first-class cricket ground is high in terms of just... the general ability for the ball to get through the keeper. So you've got that. So Lilac Hill, low bounce, Manuka Oval, medium bounce, Gabba, medium plus tax bounce. But more to the point, playing against a pink kookaburra is something that most of their batters have never done, ever. So England play, what, one day-night test every 4 years?
Yes. Yep.
Give and it's at the Adelaide Oval. And so, of all their players, if you're Zach Crawley, put yourself in his shoes. What do you reckon he wants to do? Kebabs and surfing lessons? Or a couple of those crisp cover drives that he's been dreaming of but hasn't been able to execute. I mean, seriously, give us a break.
So put yourself in that environment. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I don't know how you go with the whole baseball philosophy of it all, Teddy.
I mean, would have got the best out of me, for sure. Me, right? I would have been a fantastic glove changer. Running them out, running them back, and what drink do you want, sir?
Yeah. So if you were... Yeah, Zach Crawley, this one, perfect example, and you said you wanted the hit. Would you feel comfortable, given everything you've seen play out, McCullum and Stokes, and how heavy the pushback's been publicly about, you know, we don't need to play in this game, would you feel comfortable going to your leaders and saying, I actually would rather go to Canberra and have a hit?
60 test matches, Zach Crawley. If he doesn't know the best way to prepare, then God help him.
No one's opened the batting more in test history and averaged as
less.
Few. Yeah.
So, I mean, do I feel sorry for him? No. And I think I said on Monday was very much, if you're, and the Australian, and this is kind of maybe where the contrast between the two teams comes out. The Australian team is very player-led, we know that, around preparation. But the England team are very top-down. We have a mantra that we've all bought into and believe in, and nothing will break that down. But that is Brendan McCullum's mantra, full stop. And that is top-down, where you could almost think of the Australian team as player-up. And there's a shared culture and mission to win, but it's on the players to prepare how they want to play and prepare. Golf, hit balls, whatever. And when it becomes top-down, it is very hard to push back against that. So if you were Zach Crawley, you would feel intimidated because this is a decree from the king. And you don't... What happens to people that go against King's decree? Off with their head.
Yeah. you referred to it at the start. Obviously, the Usman Khawaja tweet. Instagram post.
You know, you're hot on the Insta.
Yeah, so flick through the little carousel and the last picture, basically, the caption something.
Looked a great hole, didn't it?
Yeah.
I'd probably give up a test career for a 9-iron into that green.
Yeah, I'm not a golfer, so I don't know how many people here are, but as you know, people that are, their whole personality's tied up in it and everything else. But
shout out to your best mate, Ben Cameron. Hope you're listening.
You flip through the Instagram post, and sure enough, the last one there is Uzi with the caption.
What do you make of that? You're asking lots of questions. Yep. So take your media hat and put it firmly on. What was your reaction?
It smelt to me as a guy that's extremely comfortable with his place in the team. Probably more so than I think the rest of us on the outside feels that someone of his output should be. And yet, that probably speaks to the fact that he feels he's locked in. Pat Cummins is commenting on it. The way Andrew McDonald spoke during the week was very much, we thought the Travis Head experiment opening was something we can look at going forward as a middle order player coming up in the second innings when the pitch flattens out. He didn't sound like he was making any noises that Head's going to open in Brisbane. And that...
Usman's playing.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the debate is, if you're Ben Stokes and Australia are batting first, who would he prefer to see walk out to bat?
100%. Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand. And there is precedent. So Watto got dropped first Test Smashers series and it ended his career. Michael Clark, mid-series. So I think things are building... And I think the Australian selectors, one thing, and we have our arguments around a few bits and bobs, no doubt. But one thing they have been is they've been consistent and, in their mind, fair. So, you know, the Australian public's job is to pick holes in that, and we do it often. But if you're thinking about fairness, you would say, we picked this guy for the first test. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have new data, but he actually didn't have an opportunity to fulfill what we thought he could. And so we'll give him another test. I think he's in the scope. So there's a difference between he's a lock and we'll see him in Sydney and let's see what happens.
Mm.
But eyes and ears are watching the game. Well, I think the selectors are on Usman watch, would be my read.
Yeah.
Do you disagree?
What's the Bart Simpson line about the ironing is delicious, where he talks about the irony, essentially, of the whole thing. To think, what we've spoken about with these selectors, is that, I'm getting there, They've had this blind spot for finding an opener, and we've spoken about it for so long that essentially they reinstated Khawaja through weight of runs. Harris got dropped, stuck with Warner despite the decline of the back end of his career, and then we can go through the whole list. Smith goes to the top to keep Bancroft out. McSweeney comes in. Constas comes in. Then it's Head. Then it's Marnus. Then it's back to Constas, and now it's Weatherald. And then the guy who's hiding in plain sight that peels off the 100 that is right there for everyone to see, they're going to take that guy and put him back in the middle order. When maybe they've got their answer that presents itself to them, and yet even when it's smacking them right in the face and the guy scores 100, they're essentially saying, you know what, we don't want it. This is the same three-man panel that's had multiple goes at finding the answer at the top of the order, and they're going to reinstate the guy that's basically averaged 26 for the last 2 years.
Because I think it plays to what I said before around fairness. They would see that as unjust and unfair to Usman, and they rebase unnecessarily selections in that kind of framework.
Fair's a place where they judge picks.
This is literally what, when I call Corbin on my way to Goldfoot or something, these are the conversations that we have. But why don't we do a little quick poll?
Yep.
Who would prefer for Travis Head to open the batting?
There
wow, that's
most hands in the room.
Overwhelming for those listening tomorrow morning.
Yeah. So as much as I know that, it was framed up as, oh, the selectors have a big call to make. It's a big call keeping it as it is and putting Khawaja back to the top. That's a significant.
That's little finger on the block for sure. And particularly if it weakens the team, and you know, given what I've just said, that I think this is the danger test. If England go 1-1. Look out. Those knives are going to be flying around.
What do you think of the golf pick? Was it funny? Was it cheeky? Or was it just tone deaf?
No, it wasn't. He knew what he was doing. It wasn't tone deaf.
Yeah.
It was a... You can beep this out. It was a... you. This is fun. Are you guys having fun? This is excellent. Excellent fun.
Mitchell Starc, we talked a lot, obviously, about... who should have been the man of the match and all the rest of it. I'd voted for Travis Head, and maybe that was...
You know, did your vote count?
No, I got overruled.
Just checking. I was just checking.
Who'd have thought guys like Jason Gillespie and Darren Lehman and...
But for the ABC Player of the Year that gets awarded Sydney, you write your 3-2-1 down.
This was part of the official voting.
Oh, bullshit.
So, yep, dead set. They collect them from multiple media organisations. They come around to us at the end of the test, say who should be the man of the match, and I got overruled on the 3 for Trav.
Uh-huh.
But maybe as part of that, we've sort of undersold the Mitchell Starc achievement of it all. So, no Hazelwood... no Cummins obviously comes out and does that. And I think it was Adam Collins actually on one of his platforms where he was talking about, is Mitchell Starc the greatest all-round bowler that Australia have had, say, in the three-format era? And when you put it into that context, immediately you think, oh, well, gee, there's been a lot of good bowlers. Hang on, you know, Mitchell Starc, his average has just dipped under 27 for the first time. But when you think about what he's done and his white ball exploits and now what he's done in the test arena, and you think, well, out of all his contemporaries, who across formats has been a better servant for Australian cricket over the last 20 years with the ball in hand than Mitchell Starc?
It's actually a pretty tough question to answer. So one thing I know is I think he is Australia's greatest ever white ball bowler. So let's take that as a given.
Yep.
His test career is... come in fits and spurts, and in actual fact his best has been the last 5 years, which is pretty hard to fathom as, what is he, 36? So the durability and skill for this guy, maybe 35, turning 36. Someone can check. We've got 200 fact checkers here. His ability to... So what was he known for with red ball cricket was the X factor. Swing the new ball early, bowl fast, maybe bowl the bumpers, ruffle a few feathers, but it definitely wasn't 7 for 50. And the last 3 years, is for whatever reason, his body has been able to be... Well, not for whatever... It takes a bloody lot of hard work. I shouldn't be that flippant. And so his best cricket has been in the last 3 or 4 years, I guess, to fast forward this. And so maybe we have a little bit of bias towards amazing performance, has been amazing for 3 years. Is he Australia's greatest three-format bowler, fast bowler?
Mm-hmm.
You'd be hard-pressed to look past Glenn McGrath, wouldn't you?
Well, only he didn't play enough T20 cricket.
Yeah, hang on.
Well, it's not two format player.
You got me. So usually in a podcast like this, I'll say, hey, stop recording. Ask the question again.
You think Mitchell Johnson? So there's a... I mean, lights was unreal.
So give me some names.
So Pat Mitch Cummins, Johnson. You could probably...
I think Josh Hazlewood. There you go.
Yeah.
I think you'd be hard... I think his... So if you it's a toss-up, but I guess where I'm taking this, a toss-up between his best format being T20 and Test cricket.
Yeah.
And you know what, you're getting ODI, where Mitch Stark was... His best format is not Test cricket. It's...
And yet he's
white ball cricket.
And yet every decision he's made in his career has been to prioritise Test cricket.
Yeah, but I think that's irrelevant. I love that. But it's not relevant to the greatest ever debate. It's a classic pub debate and we're having it in a pub.
Hazelwood's Hazelwood's playing the best T20 cricket of his career probably right now.
By far.
Yeah.
This is a guy that, don't forget, he was... So Mitch Stark, obviously, and it's the inverse, right?
Yeah.
Hazelwood was told his T20 cricket was rubbish, was on the periphery of the Australian team, went away, actually... pretty much won two IPLs off his own back, was the best player in the IPL, best bowler in the IPL, I should say, and took that skill to the international team. Mm. And they picked him off the back of his IPL form. And we all know what his red ball cricket's like. He's just phenomenal. So I'm taking Hazelwood.
Cool. No, Stark for me.
So it was a loaded question.
Show of hands. Mitchell Stark? Oh. Mm. Josh Hazelwood?
50-50?
Yeah, I think you're about right. Without counting, I think we're pretty close 50, to 50.
I appreciate all my mates in the back corner. Just love you guys.
It's the anti-Stark sentiment. Unbelievable.
No, hey, don't pitch that. Don't pitch that.
Surfaces in Test cricket. So obviously, there's been a hot debate, obviously, all week with the events that's taken place in India. Fast finishes there, fast finishes here. Comes as the backdrop, though, that we've just had England and India, obviously, over in the UK, where all five Test matches went 5 days. We sort of had a little bit of a chat about it earlier in the week, about do the organisations have an obligation to the game going forward to prepare pitches that are going to go time? Like, how important is that?
So what was... I'll reverse this question quickly. Yep. What was it about that wicket specifically that didn't enable that to happen?
Yeah, the way that
England was shit scared.
The way they played. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so how could, if you want to play a Test match in Perth, how could you have changed that wicket for that not to happen?
So you basically prepare the same way the pitches are prepared in England, which is, you know, flat road.
But it was a flat road, was it not?
No.
What did I miss?
Well, as you'd expect a pitch to do, it would seem with the new ball and had good pace and bounce.
But does in England as well, new Duke's ball, like there's a challenge, there's a technical challenge to opening the batting. So
you're saying that they took up that challenge against Bumrah at home and they didn't hear. Is that what you, that's as simple as it, the difference?
Well, I think in Australia, you've got a certain set of conditions that are given, and that is there is more pace and bounce than England. So we all know that the pace of the wicket is less, and so a lot of nicks go, you know, Joe Root, take your pick, third man, lots of balls through third man, and you can play the ball late and it runs off. You play the same shot, you're out at second slip here. So that's just what happens. And I think if Australia hadn't been emotionally frazzled in that first innings, there's a world where they score 350 and this conversation is null and void. I think the quality of the fast bowling is excellent. So let's engage that as a fact. But there was nothing in the surface that suggested that it was a two-day Test match. It was a better wicket than what it was last year. Day two was day three last year.
Yep.
And day one was T-minus one.
So
it was a perfect cricket wicket.
All right. So let's zoomed out conversation. So you set that example to one side. A two-day Test necessarily bad for the game? And
yes.
They are.
Fact.
And we're better off going...
Well, it was 2 one-dayers in the end. Like, no, like, let's kill one-day cricket. We don't need two of them back-to-back. and so...
We did promise we're going to play the hits.
Have you heard me say that before? It's a new idea that just popped into my head.
So I guess where I'm getting with this is maybe in the modern day where... Yeah, almost like we're yearning for something that no longer exists. You know, guys aren't going to go back to the nets.
So I agree with that.
So maybe are we better off as a game basically saying the batsmen are more limited today than they have been, say, in the past? Yeah.
Sure. Yep.
And so maybe we don't need spiced up pitches, whether that's in Shield cricket or it's in Test cricket. Maybe we need flatter decks because you can never get a wicket cheaper, say, in the last 50 years than you can today on average.
Have you ever been as bored as when we commentated the Melbourne Test match?
Awful.
Against India honestly, it was painful. I was commentator, the best view in the house. You're at Boxing Day, there are 90,000 people there.
Yeah.
Down the barrel, and I was sleeping in the back of the box. But it was... Like, that's not how... That's not the art. It's a flat wicket.
You could argue that the players today aren't capable of doing that. They're not capable of batting, time. So if they are going to bat for a long period,
so in Perth last year... I'll come back at you.
Yep.
What happened in the... You've got a memory like a bloody elephant. What happened what happened in the second innings when India walked out to bat?
Yeah, Yashasvi and Virat got them. Yep.
Okay, but they got them all day.
Yep.
They didn't just get them for a bit.
No.
So... This England team is an outlier. And I think I said it on Monday, in their effort to save Test cricket, they're going to be the ones that kill it if they keep going like this. And so the you got to remember, Cricket Australia and boards around the world, they budget for 4 days. And it's kind of like it's a Goldilocks zone, a four-day test match, because you can start on a Thursday and all the corporates turn up and you finish on a Sunday. The Monday gate opening, disaster. So let's think about that. If that's the Goldilocks situation, let's think about 4 days. What does it take? Maybe you play some extra overs and you go to... I mean, we always get through 90 overs in a day anyway.
Yeah.
So let's go to 96. Joking. if you're thinking about what it looks like, more day-night cricket, I think, is the answer around the world. You play more four-day test matches, particularly, and I'm not saying now, but in certain series, play four-day test matches, and you can have a highly entertaining product.
I mean,
do you disagree? Am I off base here? Or
we had a highly entertaining series between England and India, and they were played on flat pitches, and there were plenty of runs, and we didn't have a single test match where a side struggled. Oh, no, sorry, we had one where they struggled to get the 20 wickets. But other than that,
different ball.
Yep.
I just think there are nuances around the world. I don't think a blanket approach to anything kind of works. So maybe it's 5-day test in England, 4-day test in Australia. But let's be malleable in how we think about what can actually save Test cricket. Because I do know at the moment there are two series that prop up a balance sheet, and it's evaporating more. Test cricket's evaporating faster than it ever has. Ooh. And do you disagree?
There's never been... I would argue that the anticipation for this Ashes series has never been greater.
So
same as last summer when the Border Gavaskar series was here.
Okay, so what happens when Sri Lanka and Bangladesh turn up next year?
It's going to be tough sledding. Yeah.
We might even call the podcast off.
Yeah.
here's a question. What's a bigger series for you, India or England?
So media-wise,
you always talk about the Border Gavaskar as the new bloody la la la.
So I actually think this week kind of proved the point a little bit that it was that the anticipation was like nothing I'd ever seen. The media centre was more crowded for an Ashes series than it ever has been in the past. So huge numbers, the buzz was enormous, and nothing that I'd experienced like that, bigger than when India came.
Yeah.
And you could argue it's, Indian cricket fans, it's not their number one format of the game. It's the most traditional format, but Indian cricket fans will watch any kind of cricket. They're cricket fans, white ball, red ball, doesn't matter. Whereas once the cricket started, what we saw was, and far too often has happened in the history of the game, is we've got this golfing class between the two teams, particularly here in Australia. So to get a competitive Ashes series, you're looking at it's like a once in a 15, 20 year event. Whereas...
And some.
So
through time...
Yep. So 2010, 2010-11.
They've won four test matches in 20 years.
Yeah. So 86, 87.
So why were you expecting anything different?
I'm voting for India. So that's what I'm saying, that the India series is more competitive. So as a cricket fan, it's more compelling, the action on the field. But the build-up obviously isn't the same. And maybe that's...
I think that's a good breakdown, actually.
Yeah.
The on-field challenge of India is far greater than England, but the excitement around the Ashes, give it history, give it... Because you're more likely... Well, maybe you're not more likely to... work next to an Englishman than an Indian in Sydney. But
so if it ends up being basically the old tri-series played out over 3 years and we just play England and India every second summer.
I think that's sad.
It is, but is that...
Because England...
Does that... Yeah. But is that going to keep Test cricket strong or is it going to kill Test cricket?
I think it kills Test cricket. Because, like, so we've just seen South Africa beat India.
Yep.
In India.
And they don't play a single home Test match in a 12-month cycle when they're the best in the world.
Isn't that wild? So, again, this is nothing new, but we're going to look up and the game is going to be so far removed from what we wish it was. It's, it saddens the heart. But so let's enjoy it while we can.
Yes. It's a very pessimistic view for a Wednesday night at the pub, but we'll see what we get the remainder of the series. All right, just to bring it back to the here and now, so Andrew McDonald's press conference. I was an attentive listener. I wasn't actually part of the press conference. But
let me guess. I don't listen to press conference.
20 minutes?
I'm not part of the media. But given that the Cricket Australia encroachment on how the media dictates what needs to be asked and said, I reckon they didn't ask Andrew one question about golf.
Zero.
Are you serious?
Zero. Yeah. Which was...
That's hilarious.
I haven't spoken to anyone that was part of the press conference, but there were lots of questions about Usman and his preparation and his recovery and everything else, but there was no question about whether his preparation for it was the way to go. So I know I've talked about it a few times and... Uzi's obviously shared his picture and everything else. I guess the analogy that I would draw in my profession, for example, like if I went out for a few beers the night before a test, my employer wouldn't have an issue with that, right? But if I had 10 beers, went to karaoke and I couldn't speak the next day...
it's a fair analogy.
Then my employer would be very unhappy with that. I imagine they'd be saying, what are you doing the night before the test match starts? So in Uzi's case, fair play to him. If he wants to go and play golf, good luck to him. Played 3 rounds in 3 days and... You would know as the golfer as to how much that takes out of you as a, it's a 5-6 hour exercise.
Plenty. One game, not so much. Yep. The thing that caught my ear was 3 in 3 days.
Yeah.
Because generally you're back, you're rotating and you're trying to hit a ball. Your back gets sore.
Yep. All of that. And then whether you're mentally locked in and all the rest of it. And sure enough, he's not available to do what his primary task is.
I'm glad he pulled out of the Australian PGA this week at Royal Queensland.
Yeah.
I mean, that really would have fucked his preparation for Brisbane.
So the other things that he spoke about was Nathan Lyon basically guaranteed that he'll be playing in Brisbane. Said, the middle session can be a bit benign in these
null and void
tests.
Null and void.
Yep, no problems there.
Yeah.
Looks like Pat Cummins isn't going to play.
Oh.
And it's just, again, if you put your finger in the wind and sort of try to pick up on all of that. Basically said he's no guarantees. They don't want to force his return. And almost sort of revisited some of the comments that he'd made earlier, basically saying, hey, if you see him in Perth and he looks like he's ready to go, he's further back than what you actually think he is. So he's on the comeback trail, but he's not going to play.
What did I say on the overs-unders on two tests?
Yeah, you were under 2.5. Yeah.
On track. So I win.
And then Josh Hazlewood, they are maintaining, despite the reports, that he'll play at some stage throughout the series.
Interesting. That injury is worse than what I first thought. I got excited when they scanned him the first time after the Shield game out the back here and they saw nothing, and then it was 2 days before they scanned again. I thought, something minor, and it's a two-weeker.
Yep.
Doesn't feel like it, does it?
Do you want to role-play something then? If I'm a member of the press...
I'd love to.
So you're Andrew McDonald and or George Bailey, member of the selection panel, and you're getting asked questions about Usman Khawaja. And I say to you... What happened with Usman's Khawaja prep for the Perth Test match? How would you answer that if you're in that role?
So you would have asked that question because you're a hard-hitting journalist?
Shots fired.
You did ask the question of the Australian captain and he gave you a bit of a terse response, didn't he? Look, there's kind of... you're in the media seat where you think ultimate transparency is the best answer. And so I know the on-air team were blowing up when the media came through saying, oh, he's off for a stretch and a piss or something. Like, why would they say it? There's no advantage in the middle of the game of giving anything other than that response. You are in a competitive series of a lifetime, perhaps. Why would you give them any kind of psychological or edge to say anything else? So that's... I'm just kind of trying to bucket this. Okay.
Yep.
We're now post-fact. They need to be accountable for how their players prepare, or the players need to be accountable. So, I don't know, an answer along the lines, and I'm kind of pulling something out of thin air here. We trust our players to prepare how they want to prepare. That can involve leisure activities, that can involve hitting lots of cricket balls. Ultimately, they're accountable for their performances and will be held to that account by us.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that doesn't always happen, does it? And we've kind of seen that play out. But that's how that, I mean, that seems a legitimate response, does it not?
Yeah. But again, if you, they're hollow words if then you don't follow through on those.
So it's how they run their
program. So it's almost like, let's reverse engineer it so we don't get asked the question, so we don't have to answer it as a way to kind of dodge that. Yeah. I guess, the broader, as we love to do, sort of zoomed out lens on this is, I always talk about it feels like today more than ever in the past that the Australian cricket team is treated almost like a franchise team, like a T20 side, and people roll up and they expect they're going to play. And even you speak to the players and they talk about tours that are, you know, off into the distance.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, you'd have to be selected for that tour.
Invited.
Invited, yep. Yeah. Whereas there would be, there's this comfortability that they will be on it and that they're part of the core group in particular. And there'll be a few changes on the fringes. So, is this just what we need to get used to in the modern state of cricket, that basically if you're Pat Cummins, and we sort of lived through it with Bancroft, but it wasn't so implicit, obviously, in the way that it played out publicly, and he says, I want to play in a team that I feel comfortable in, I want to play with the people I want to play with, I'll be well remunerated for it, but I also know I'm taking a haircut because I could go and play T20 cricket, for example, and do something else. So part of the almost trade-off or the agreement is that we have this culture that we've cultivated, that is familiar and that is a safe space for us. Is there part of that that we're living through in modern cricket more than we ever have in the past?
Yes, but I actually think it's pretty specific to this particular team, because that wasn't necessarily the case under the former coach, and it definitely wasn't the case when I was playing, and certainly dynamics have changed. So I think very much Andrew McDonald and Pat Cummins as that combination, and George Bailey is the chief selector, that is their mantra. But you can imagine if Andrew McDonald isn't the coach anymore and Pat Cummins isn't the captain, I don't necessarily think that is how the team would be run. I think the dynamics are still at play around, hey, I could go and play elsewhere. But that is, they're kind of unicorn players. So yes, some of them could, but not all of them. And this next crop, I'm not so sure. They're going to have to prove themselves somewhere, and they're either going to prove themselves playing for Australia or playing overseas, and there's not that many opportunities playing overseas.
No, but the top guys, definitely.
And the top guys are about to retire. So who are the next top guys?
Whoever they turn out to be. But I just wonder, when that day comes, are we going to be careful? Are we going to be a little bit like, gee, this is, we sort of wanted this to happen, sort of to go back to how it was, and now all of a sudden the best player in Australia, and I'll just use Pat as an example, but it could be anyone, for example, that all of a sudden is now on the franchise tour and he doesn't represent Australia anymore.
That's a real risk, by the way. But that's, I think it comes down to a couple of things. One is your emotional connection to want to play Test cricket and test yourself to do that, because playing T20 cricket isn't that much fun. It's great money, but it's not that much fun if you're a cricketer. The second thing is, I think it depends on the landscape, and actually, and you know, we haven't talked about T20 privatisation, but if an IPL team or teams buy Big Bash teams, I think there's more of an opportunity to do both. You can play franchise cricket and carve out time for you're in a better position to leverage that than excluding those teams and there's tension between those. So you actually bring them into the tent and you understand how the player kind of ecosystem can benefit you on certain occasions rather than harm you. Separate topic, but
yeah, no, absolutely. Have you got any?
Take some questions.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing. So this time next week,
you're grilling me. I'm feeling absurd.
No,
sure
we love it.
Questions.
We love the insights. This time next week, obviously, it'll be the night before the Brisbane Test. So we're exactly 1 week away.
I'm going to be there.
Test Eve.
It's not a live podcast, but I've actually got a corporate box. I've been invited to a corporate box. Fun. I'm the guest. And we obviously are now recording these daily shows after the test match. So there's a world where I'm not at my absolute best for that.
To be fair, I think Saturday night you jumped off.
I wasn't at my best.
Jumped off a 15-hour flight from LA, and you were
15 hours or 15 schooners, who knows what happens.
All right, let's do that. Let's take some questions. What's the best way to do it? Tegan's got a microphone, so if anyone's got a question, we'll...
You still having fun? I'm
Guys, you spoke about legacy, or you spoke about Stark's legacy. Can you talk about the cartel's legacy, and maybe cartel plus Gaz, and where you think they sit in the whole realm of bowling units from the dawn of time?
We're also, I know you can't talk to brands on the ABC. This looks like a Frank Green, but I think it could be a dupe. But anyone who asks a question gets a water bottle. Corbin, you go first.
Statistically, they're as good as the game's ever seen. We've never Rick Finlay talks all the time about the quartet, so no quartet's ever taken as many wickets together. And as a guy that was born in the early 90s, I used to always talk about, you know, Lee McGrath, Gillespie, Warne. And it's incredible how limited cricket that those guys actually played together, that there was always some other combination, whether it was Kasperwitz or,
Lee.
You know, Warney's ban or whatever Lee. It turned out to be, that somehow upset that combination. So... statistically, there is...
Do you think it was stuffed after they retire? Like, as a quartet?
No. I think it'll be...
Mainly because the quality of the... It will definitely be different.
Yeah.
So due to the quality of the batting around the world? Or?
No, but if you looked at the depth chart right now, so you looked at the next guy in line in every position, so say right now you would say it's what... who so Boland, Abbott...
Boland's dumb. He's 35 years old. He ain't taking the mantle of the next quartet.
Kuhneman, whoever the next guy is in
they're each good, but yeah, these guys. I played a lot of. I was lucky enough to play a lot of cricket as Stark, Cummins, Hazelwood came through the ranks. You knew they were generational at 16 or 17, and they got wrapped in cotton wool and they got serviced everything you could ever imagine. We saw a glimpse of it. Pat Cummins, you know, in those first couple of Shield games when he bowled 150 k's an hour. Hazelwood, Stark, they played Test cricket at 22. So this next batch, they're good, but are they generational?
Yeah.
I don't think you could answer yes.
Never been a better time in the history of the game to be a bowler than
that's
today.
True. Just bowl at six stump, back of a length, and tell your slip catchers to warm their hands up. Easy. Like, I reckon I could do that. Boulder Zach Crawley, new pill. Whoop. Thank you.
I hope that answers part of that as well.
I think they're the best ever as well.
Yep.
Here's a tricky one. If you had to merge those quartets, what would you...
Ooh.
Who would you pick?
As in what your best four would be? That's a great question.
Mitch Stark, the best three-format player of all time.
you think if the comps...
Oh, you're going to leave him out, aren't you?
If you think the comps Hazelwood and McGrath, you can't not pick McGrath.
Mm-hmm.
So then if it's Warne and Lyon, you got to pick Warney. And then the other two are probably Cummins and Stark. Stark gives you the variations of left armour, as good as... Statistically, he's going to be just as good as anyone.
It's a good answer.
It's a fair attack.
It's hard to get you, isn't it?
Speaking of young talent, can you give us your three best players to watch from a bowling format and also a batting format for the next 5 years, and particularly who you see as the next superstars representing Australia in all three formats, or at least two formats, to cement their side?
Corbin, Jake Fraser-McGurk, Marcus Harris... And who else?
Who's the guy?
Sammy Kaye, the Kaye gun.
We are in New South Wales, so go on, just take us through the rookie list at the Blues.
There we go.
In fairness, we spoke about Lachie Shaw the other day.
Excellent cricketer.
He can go. Yeah, he's a seriously
good player. He'll play for Australia, for sure.
So what he's batting top five at the moment, he's a wicketkeeper, isn't he? But can play as a
You must be very conflicted here because he probably should be keeping wickets.
Hey.
But your mate Josh... Holding him up, no. He'll get his time.
Yep.
I mean, Philippi, excellent cricket. I'm being facetious. Maybe you can blank that one out. Philippi, excellent, but...
Yeah.
I mean, there's a... New South Wales now have three excellent keepers.
Yep. I think the The temptation is, I reckon, when we go from one generation to the next, is immediately to look to the guys that are in their early 20s or their late teens. When really, as we talk about all the time, you come into your batting prime when you hit 30. So who are the guys that are 25 to 27 or 28 or yep. whatever, as they're more likely going to be that age profile that are going to be the next guys? And you talk about Philippe, he sits in that category at the moment, but it's his contemporaries. It's the guys that played in and around that time. McSweeney, possibly... Possibly recast as a middle order player.
McSweeney, your mate Matt Renshaw.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that we always forget, and you're right, just to play this out a little bit, we always say, who are the next five? You only need two. Mm. You need two generational players every 10 years. So we've been lucky that we've had Smith and Warner together. We're talking batting, and very lucky that we had the three fast bowlers together. But if you have two of each, you've got a pretty good team and you can work around the guys that play 60 or 70 tests, not 120, or 20 tests that contribute yeah. and you can work it out. So who are your players? That's answered the question.
Oh.
I think Campbell Callaway can
yes.
bat a lot.
Yep.
Every time I see him bat, I think he's test cricketer in the making. If you're talking, let's talk under 23.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's excellent. So he's probably the pick of the next batch that haven't played for mine.
Yep. Todd Murphy's only...
22.
24.
He's got old.
Yeah. But he got a 5 on test debut.
Yeah.
And you think he'll get an opportunity at some point. We've obviously seen how effective a finger spinner can be here. So what, we're putting Callaway down? Yep. Are you holding faith with Kagan?
Yes.
All right. And we'll take Lachie Shaw as well as another New South Welshman at 22. And then the bowling department. So say we take Todd Murphy.
You've got a list there.
I do.
That's not fair. Ollie Peakes is a good cricketer.
He's another batsman. Then you're into your Vidlers and your...
You know what? So Vidler.
Yep.
So in my mind, as a fast bowler, you need three things. To be great. You need yeah. two to be functional. Mm-hmm. You either need airspeed, you need bounce up or down, yep. or you need movement side to side. So if you look at those three kind of barrels,
yep.
and you put who are the great bowlers, they have all three. Vidler has one of them. He's 5'10", so he doesn't get the ball up,
mm-hmm.
and he got bowls with good speed, but he doesn't really move the ball. So when you say his name, I think prospect, but okay. get your wrist right.
What about Marley Beardman?
Haven't seen enough of him.
Proper speed.
Haven't seen enough of him.
Yeah.
Is he tall?
Yeah, big dude.
So he's got two of the three. Yep. Pick him.
We'll take him. That's our list. All right.
I'm just interested to know how far you think Jason Sanger is away from serious consideration, given he had a great year last year, brilliant knock in the final. Doesn't seem to be talked about a lot. Interested in your thoughts.
He's not scoring any runs.
Yeah. He's our content capture man, isn't he, Jason Sanger? So
we got hot on him early.
We did. So there was
a very hot on him early. So I think he's a very good player, and I think the move that he made has been great for his career, and I think he will probably play test cricket at some stage. But one thing I do know, if you want to force test selection, the best way is to get big hundreds consistently. So don't do it for one season and then fall out of a conversation, because people will leapfrog you. And yeah. he's been leapfrog. So I would have said at the start of the season he was 3 cabs back, maybe waiting for a little ride from the airport. I reckon he's now 7.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon?
There's been a lot of runs, hasn't there? Which even when we look through that list, for example, the previous question about three batters and three bowlers, easier to find. The batting prospects under 25 than it is to find the bowling prospects.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that also stands to reason. Bowlers often have injuries early in the piece.
But it can change quickly. One thing I know is you get 300s in a row, your name gets talked about at the Olympic Hotel, it gets talked about by the selectors, and, you can build momentum pretty quickly.
Mm. New South Wales thought he was a guy, didn't they? They wanted to, which maybe to his own detriment, got pushed.
I think that's the good signal there is to his own detriment. He got every opportunity, and probably to his own admittance, it was gifted to him a little easily, yeah. And having to go and prove yourself, and I had the same experience in my own career, to go and prove yourself and have to win games and learn and be your own coach and actually go and do it was great for him. So more props to him.
All right, let's keep moving. Where's... Tegan's got one down here.
Hey there. You said there's going to be a demise in Test cricket. What makes you make that assumption, and how will it come about?
Because there are 10 Test nations, and 3 of them make money out of the format of the game. So eventually, unless the ICC are willing to pay for that, it dies. And we're in the middle of that. Sad. So it can still be saved, but if you're put yourself in the shoes of the New Zealand Cricket Board, and every test match costs you $1 million, how many test matches are you going to play? It's sad. So to flip that, if we can find a funding arrangement for the game, so at the moment India take not half, but much more than half of all revenue in cricket goes into their pocket. So unless they're willing to fund other countries to play Test cricket, eventually, I'm not saying in the next 2 years or 5 years, but eventually they're going to stop playing and it's going to suck. So we need to fix it. See the guy behind you? He works at Cricket Australia. Go talk to him.
We do have a bunch of questions up here at the back. I'm going to
avoid the back corner. I know that.
Ed, what are your lasting memories of your 100 against South Africa? And
is this a plant?
Oh man.
And what are your memories?
I actually asked my wife to ask the same question, but you are not my wife. So, my lasting memory. I'll keep this. That's so self-indulgent. I'm going to keep this super, super short. Jeez, I played well that day. joking. That's not my style. My lasting memory was almost the same emotion of when I was given my baggy green, and it was almost a badge that all the people that had contributed to my life and my career could then wear to say that that effort had been justified. So my dad, who threw me balls in the nets till his arm would fall off, to all my coaches, to my wife, who had to put up with a screaming baby while I'm, you know, off doing whatever around the world. So it just felt like a validation of all those moments for them, because they had given up so much for me.
So just playing wasn't enough? Like just getting your baggy green and debuting?
Well, it was the same emotion, but it was probably amplified, I'd say.
I was wondering why you were going to Brisbane. It's all this pilgrimage every year, just making sure you revisit the...
No, it's to see my statue.
Yeah.
That's how good 100 it was.
We've got lots of hands in the air. We'll take a few more. We'll take a few more, and then we'll stop the record. And
oh, I thought we'd stopped already.
A couple of others.
So lots of chat about the ageing Australian players and who's going to replace them. I'm interested to know what your thoughts are about the next Australian captain coming up behind them.
You go. I think we're going to agree on this.
South Australian? Yeah. <That's> Go on.
I think it'll be Alex Carey in the short term.
Mm. Over Travis Head?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't get a better pin-up boy for the game, could you, than Travis Head?
Oh, stick him on the Weet-Bix box.
Yeah.
Even I go, honestly, you think Pat Cummins good looking? Have a look at Alex Carey.
I thought you were going to say, have a look at Travis Head.
You know, I actually tempted my little nephew. I said, you know, this is justification. You go get the Travis Head haircut. I'll pay for it. Yeah. Imagine that, going to school on Monday with just nothing on the side of his head.
It's a good question. So you're going Carey. I'll go Trav.
One thing I do, if Nathan McSweeney can play more Test cricket,
You can't be on that train.
I'm not on the train. I'm just giving an opinion. And that is, if he can get in the test team, I think they see him as a future Australian test cricket captain. Yeah.
Give us your realistic 11 for the tour of South Africa in 2026. Any good male in the New South Wales, old blokes as well, please, Teddy. Mm.
Next September.
September 26. I don't think Steve Smith's playing test cricket in September 26.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sydney's going to be his last test match.
Yep.
I know, I've got no mail.
Mm.
I actually think he was pretty close to retiring after the World Test Championship. I reckon he had to be talked into playing.
Yep.
So there's one. I think there's a world in my... I think Mitch Stark might retire in Sydney.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe. If it's not this year, it's next year.
Yeah. There's never as much...
I think Usman's retiring in Sydney as well.
Yeah. There's never as much turnover as you think, though, is there? Like, say Inglis comes in the middle.
Money's too good.
Yeah.
Money and the ego gets in the way of most decisions, I reckon.
Yeah. So what did you say? You said Mitch Stark as well.
Definitely in the next... If it's not this Sydney test, it might be another one.
Mm. Okay.
Because there's a dynamic of... Healy and Stark of, I'm sure that at some stage they want to have a family. Mm-hmm. That probably doesn't get put in the algorithm of how we think when people retire.
So it could all, they could exit the game together. Yeah.
Would you rather retire having won the Ashes 5-0, think McGrath, Warne, Langer, Hayden, you name, and they put their silly hand up and the fireworks go off and you've just won the Ashes, the SCG, your home ground against England, 40,000 people, 50,000 people going off the brains? Or when you play Sri Lanka next year, or whoever we're playing, and there are 12 people and a dog giving you a little golf clap. What would you prefer, Corbin?
Well, the new way to go is to the farewell, isn't it? It's, hey, pick the point 18 months in the future and say, hey, that's the time.
Or in Dave Warner's case, 3 years, yeah.
I'm gonna go at that particular stage. Yeah. But no, I understand what you're saying. For everyone following along at home, thanks so much for staying with us throughout our little question time and Teddy's cursed language and everything else. But that has been this latest edition of the ABC Cricket Podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.